Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Okay, so the coronavirus, as you know, we've been talking about it for the last 2 weeks. And last week I said to everybody, you know, wear a mask when you travel, ask for a glove change if they go through your bags. Well, I want to reiterate that bit of information because things are moving fast, as usually happens, although in a viral infection, particularly one that's getting this level of scrutiny. However, it's turning out to be fairly contagious. More about that in a moment. More contagious than SARS actually was, which is a surprise. And so far, the mortality is substantially lower. Only about 20% of the people who actually get the coronavirus actually get very sick. 80% do pretty well. Of the people who get very sick, we're seeing a mortality rate of 2 to 3%. Now, the denominator is going to shift as we start doing more testing. More about that in a moment. But effectively, what we're looking at here is data in motion. And so it's sort of interesting if you can get out from under the emotionality of it all to understand that this is a new disease. We don't have its characteristics. It's best to play it safe. There are, as of today, 77,000 cases. By the way, the New York Times has an official web page for the coronavirus. It's really going viral. Sorry. There are 170 people officially dead or dead officially of this. That's probably a really substantial undercount, particularly in China, where the testing kits are in short supply and you're only getting identified as having died of the disease if, in fact, they can test you. Today, 195 Americans were evacuated from Wuhan. This was mostly embassy staff, but also a few people, news reporters and the like, who were in the town. These people are going to be treated to a 3-day all-expense-paid vacation at Marsh Air Force Base in Southern California while they wait for the results of their blood tests to come back. If their blood tests are negative for viral DNA, then they will be allowed to travel to their final destinations, where they will be under a sort of 14-day quote-unquote close observation to make sure they don't get sick. Other news, the World Health Organization is still debating about whether to declare a global health emergency. Let's see, what are we now? 5 days ago, they met and decided, no, we're not going to, after heavy lobbying from China, I might add, according to the French newspaper Le Monde, nothing about that in the American press. Now that there is evidence of transmission, particularly in Europe, from people who returned from Wuhan to other people who were not in Wuhan, that may change. There's one office in Germany where I guess it was a multinational corporation. They had a training. A guy came from Wuhan who was there for the training. He went back to China and somebody got sick. Now there's four people sick in the office with the virus. So they were all exposed and managed to catch it in this is a not great setting. This is definitely more flu-like than cold-like. These are people sitting in the same room, presumably not having any direct physical contact, and this still managed to pass between them. So, yeah, masks looking really good. Lots of hand washing, lots of masks. By the way, British Airways and Air Canada have canceled all flights to and from China, which is pretty interesting event. There has been a substantial decline in demand for travel to China. And so many other airlines have curtailed the number of flights they're offering, but are still offering them. This is a moving target. My advice to you is to pretend you're in a really bad flu epidemic. And if you are a person who's got lung disease, let's say you've got emphysema or you've got bad bronchitis or you have autoimmune disease and you're taking one of those disease-modifying agents, this would be a really good time to be extraordinarily careful. Cancel, I would say, any travel that you can avoid in the next couple of weeks. Think about avoiding large venues. And if you do go to a large venue, consider wearing a mask. Certainly, if you go to a hospital, consider wearing a mask. I don't think anyone is going to look twice at you if you're walking down a hospital corridor wearing a mask, as that's kind of, well, it's the uniform for people who choose not to get vaccinated for flu in a hospital. A little Associated Science article. This is being reprinted by Science Daily because it's so relevant to the current situation. But this was published in the September 3rd Journal of the American Medical Association, if you want to go and look at it. This was a study done by the University of Texas Southwestern Division of Infectious Diseases and Geographic Medicine. The senior author was Trish Pearl, and what they looked at was, do you need to wear those tighter-fitting N95 respirators that fit over the nose and mouth very carefully versus the looser-fitting surgical masks typically worn by us healthcare workers in the hospital? And those N95 masks are in seriously short supply right now. The answer is probably not. The study reported no significant difference in the effectiveness of medical masks versus N95 respirators for prevention of influenza or other viral respiratory illnesses. This is also echoed by a large study conducted back in 2009 when H1N1 came to the United States. You've got to protect your nose and mouth. We touch our nose and mouth a lot, and the mask is probably mainly working by preventing you from conveying stuff you pick up on your hands when you scratch your nose or put something in your mouth. It is pretty true that there is not high superiority of these N95 masks. We're talking about under normal sorts of disease transmission. We're not talking about biosafety level one, level four labs or something like that. But funny story, as I was talking to one of my studio mates today about coronavirus, which is in the news, probably getting almost as much play in my particular news feed as the impeachment hearings. She mentioned that her husband really cleaned up, quote unquote, in the market. He's one of those guys that buys like leftover stuff that's being marked down, stuff that didn't get sold or stuff that got returned, and he resells it. Well, he just happened to buy 800,000 masks just in 2003, just before SARS came along, and there was a great shortage of respiratory masks, and apparently he really cleaned up, probably helped pay for his retirement. And, you know, that's a classic example of being in the right place at the right time. So we're going to start with Carrie, who writes from somewhere, not quite sure where. Carrie writes, Dear Dr. Don, I've called your show several times and always appreciate your help. On October 21st, my father started having sciatic pain in the left buttock and low back. 2 days later, he developed blisters on his left foot and toes, which moved up his lower leg and up to his knee. All right. I'm wanting a show of hands out there in the audience. How many people think they know what Carrie's father's got? Well, if you said shingles, you'd be right. And the classic sign of shingles is a blistering rash in a stripe, kind of a zebra stripe. If you go take a look at the picture of a zebra, those lines on the zebra are actually pigment dermatomes, and they follow the spinal segments. So every single stripe is a nerve coming out of the spinal cord, and we have something similar going on in our mapping. And typically, when you get shingles, it will be the virus waking up in one neuron, one soma, which is to say the ganglion where all of the cell bodies for all of the neurons in a particular nerve root live in the spinal column or in the base of the brain, and then they come flying out and wrap into their distribution. In the case of zebras, that distribution is an alternating pigment, no pigment being turned on. And so you get the stripes. In us, Well, you get the stripes of blisters, and that's how we know it's the same thing. Getting back to Carrie's dad, he was in Germany, where he lives 6 to 8 months of the year at the time. He went to his doctor, who prescribed acyclovir for 5 days and novaminsulfone, which is an antibiotic. He developed partial paralysis in his left foot. He had severe pain, so was referred to a pain specialist. That doc prescribed gabapentin, 100 milligrams, 3 times a day. They gradually increased the dose to 600 milligrams, 3 times a day. The doctor also prescribed Norco. My father said that this helped, and now the sores are mostly gone. Norco, by the way, folks, is hydrocodone. However, he still takes the gabapentin because he still has quite a lot of pain, and he still has the partial paralysis in his left foot. And this started in October. We're now in January, so we're about 4 months out, which is not a great sign for the paralysis, I'm afraid. Before we go on, I parenthetically want to comment that that's a pretty minimal dose for a duration for zoster. We typically use 10 days in this country, and the gabapentin dose was also fairly conservative. Now, I'm nothing against conservative, and with an older person, you do start low and ramp up, but I just find the difference in medical practice, obviously, not all of it's lore and what you were taught to do by the people who taught you to do it, who were taught by the people who taught them to do it. So not all of these protocols are highly scientific. But the plaque thickens. He also has collagenous colitis. He has been treated for this, but nothing has worked to change the problem, which is chronic watery diarrhea. He's been through 2 8-week regimens of budesonide, 9 milligrams a day, but the watery diarrhea comes back as soon as he stops it. A new doctor told him he needed to taper off the budesonide for this to work, so now he's on a new regimen, and she gives the tapering schedule, which I won't bother to read. What do you think of all this? Do you think he was correctly diagnosed with the shingles? Yeah, I think he probably was. Is there anything you would recommend for the shingles pain or healing from the shingles? Yeah, I probably would. Let's start out with the fact that I'm fine with the gabapentin dose he's on. I do think that giving him things that are good for the mitochondria, which are damaged in situations like this and are having a hard time recovering, would be a good strategy. So I will typically use a good deal of fish oil, fairly high doses, like 500 to 1,000 milligrams of phosphatidylcholine, which just helps rebuild, along with the fish oil, the nerve cell membranes. Fish oil dose. Get that DHA level, which is the main one the neurons up to 1,000 milligrams a day. You may need to clear that with the doctor if your dad's on any blood thinners, but otherwise it should be fine. These are over-the-counter health food type items, and another one that's helpful for the nerves and particularly for neuropathy, so I would always use this, is something called alpha-lipoic acid, often abbreviated ALA. Alpha-lipoic acid. Dose on that, maybe 300 milligrams twice a day. Big dose. I'd probably give a good blast of B100, B complex, also helpful for the nerves. But the ALA we use all the time in diabetic neuropathy, and it really helps. And so I think it's a reasonable extension to give it to someone with post-herpetic neuropathy. So with respect to the collagenous colitis, that's a bit more difficult nut to crack. Collagenous colitis is a type of inflammation of the colon, which is invisible, basically. If the guy goes up there with his periscope, he's not going to see anything. It looks pretty normal on colonoscopy, but if you do a biopsy, you're going to see a number of things. You might see layers of pink stuff. That's the collagenous colitis. And you might see white blood cells. That would be the lymphocytic colitis. These are both called microscopic colitis because the itis is only visible microscopically. There is an association with autoimmune diseases. People who, there are some associations with use of proton pump inhibitors, H2 blockers, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. As a functional medicine doctor, I look at this and it's got food sensitivity, food-induced inflammation written literally all over it. The fact that it's worse with cigarette smoking also tends to also tends to make me feel like that's probably a thing. So if you can get to a functional medicine doctor with your dad next time he's in the United States, you're going to need to do that, because the functional medicine assessment is personalized. And while the treatment for the post-herpetic inflammation of the nerves is stereotyped, the treatment of that collagenous colitis needs to be specific for the individual. So I hope that helped. We're going to go to our first caller of the evening, and that is Maria. Hello, Maria. You're from Santa Cruz, right?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. What can we talk about?
Well, it's not as exciting as the coronavirus, but pseudogout. Basically, I'm a 58-year-old woman that was recently diagnosed in the fall with pseudogout through the arthrocentesis of a massive amount of swelling. And then, to make a long story short, just recently, I had the flu, a really bad flu. And lo and behold, yes, I started feeling the symptoms of pseudogout coming back in my left knee. It very much scared me, and I understood it in terms of the inflammation and the high white count or whatever. But I just wanted to talk to you a bit, basically about how to prevent and manage flare-ups. I actually took a heap of different anti-inflammatory herbs and anti-inflammatory diet, and the flare-up has already left me. But I feel now, I get it, that, okay, I have a long-term issue, and I need to really pay attention and take really good care of myself. So I'm hoping that you might have some tips for me on how to prevent these flare-ups and how to manage them when, if they happen.
Okay, well, Well, I like what you're doing with your anti-inflammatory herbs. Was one of them Boswellia by any chance?
No, actually, it was, what I used was mostly a lot of ginger root.
Mm-hmm.
And when I said anti-inflammatory herbs, it was sort of a catch-all. I also used fish oil, mm-hmm. a lot of fish oil, and vitamin D3.
Okay.
And what else? Magnesium, actually. Magnesium, which one? Oh, gosh.
Oh, that's okay.
I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. It's all right. Yeah. I was just curious.
Okay.
So yeah. I think you chose you chose some good ones. It's interesting about the, okay. So first of all, this is like gout in that you get redness and swelling in your joints, but it tends to hit different places. So it's more knees. Knees are classic for, pseudo gout, and, it's just like the big toe is classic for the uric acid form of gout. So what we like to do with in pseudogout is make sure that we keep the magnesium levels normal. That's a functional medicine thing. And you want to be sure, first of all, you probably shouldn't take calcium supplements. And you probably should make sure that the iron level is in your blood is fairly low. You don't want to be anemic, but you could, for example, check your serum iron. And if it's in the high, you know, above the 50th percentile on the range, probably a good idea to give blood and check your supplements. Maybe eat a little bit less red meat. Try to reduce the amount of iron in your diet, because the more iron tends to be correlated with this. So too much calcium, too much iron, or not enough magnesium. And there is an association with a underactive thyroid. So you might want to check your thyroid gland, maybe have them check a intact parathyroid, just to make sure you don't have one of these secondary drivers for the pseudogout. Any family history of this?
No, not that I know of. I mean, I'd have to ask all my cousins, but certainly no direct family history of it.
Yeah, so, you know, it's typically what we end up doing if we can, and knees are easy, is we tap the joint and we look at the crystals, and that gives us a clear diagnosis. A lot of times people kind of guess that that's what it is. Did you have your joint tapped or not?
No, I totally had it tapped. I went to the ER, and he threw out 40 milliliters of fluid and checked a lot of things, but yeah, it was positive for the crystals.
It's pretty amazing how inflamed they can get. And you can't really tell the difference between people who run a low-grade fever. You can't tell if it's a bacterial joint infection, which, by the way, if you miss, the person will have a very bad arthritis in that joint forever. So they will be sad they will be mad and you will feel bad. So those are the things we want to avoid.
And I want to really prevent that.
Yes.
I'm scared of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think the most important thing for you to do is a mm-hmm. low inflammatory diet. And so mm-hmm. that means healthy food, not a lot of fast food, not a lot of junk, mm-hmm. probably certainly limit your exposure to trans fats and mm-hmm. High levels of polyunsaturated fats, even mm-hmm. Lots of the healthier monounsaturated oils like olive oil are really good. You can't make and they mm-hmm. are much less inflammatory. And mm-hmm. so those are all good cooking tips. And a regular exercise, avoiding dehydration. And when you do get mm-hmm. sick, when you start to get a cold or any other kind of thing where your immune system's going to get revved up, mm-hmm. hydration, 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 and add in that boswellia.
Okay, I'm going to write boswellia.
Yeah,
now.
Boswellia yeah. is frankincense. And it is, you know, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Turns out what they brought him was they brought him money. They brought him they brought him Motrin, and they brought him room deodorizer. So, those are all very good, useful presents when you're an infant, I think. but probably Mary and Joseph were the ones who really got the advantage out of the myrrh and the frankincense, I'm guessing. The gold, on the other hand, you know, you can, even as a baby, you can always use that. The most important thing here is, as I said, an anti-inflammatory diet, and that's essentially mm-hmm. plant-based protein. You can have the occasional steak, the occasional chicken. You know, try to stay organic and free range, and you know, humane, mm-hmm. and all of that. But in general, meat protein is more inflammatory, and so we were going to talk a little bit about inflammation in the context of the collagenous colitis, but I just want to take a moment and pull this article, which I know, of course, you know, I've got a stack of them here, and it's going to be the one. Here it is. So it's relevant because what most people don't realize is that eating is pro-inflammatory. So whenever you eat anything, even the perfect, you know, I don't know, Buddha bowl or whatever you want to consider the perfect food, you know, it's going to automatically ramp up a hormone in your intestines called VIP, which stands for vasoactive intestinal peptide. And what that does is it dilates the blood vessels, which is good because you've got calories in there, you proteins and stuff. You want to go send more blood in there to pick them up. But it also activates the immune system, particularly a whole bunch of immune cells called ILC3. And they are 70% of your immune system is in your gut, surrounding your intestines, because most of the potential infections that could kill you are going to get into your bloodstream through your gut. And mm-hmm. so our bodies, evolution has designed us to resist being eaten alive by those bacteria. And these IL-3 cells, and there's two things, it'll either be putting food in your mouth or it will be your circadian rhythm. So when you are getting into the time of day when you normally eat, this VIP inflammation will turn on even if you haven't eaten anything. So I think this is part of the reason why this idea of intermittent fasting is getting such traction in people with inflammatory diseases. And there's tons of anecdotal comments out there, and I've got all of my patients adapting this, you know, willy-nilly. Got plenty of internet juice, but the ones who have pain and inflammation do really seem to be getting a benefit from it. So I think collapsing your eating as a preventative, you know, eat the right stuff, but also try to have a period of at least 12 hours. And, you know, if you can manage 14, that would probably be better. But if you only eat for a 10-hour stretch during the day, like after 8 a.m. and before 6 p.m., that could be a really great preventative if you can swing it.
Okay.
And the reason is that means that, you know, you've got 12, oh, at least 12 hours. Anybody can do 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. And if you've got 12 hours that you're not eating during the day, that's 12 hours when you're not making these inflammatory markers, these inflammatory proteins. And the same advice to Carrie, who wrote me about her father, I think that also would be, you know, an extremely good strategy to use. I really do. So I think that covers your pseudogout. I do hope that you will get yourself tested for food sensitivities, however, and because that could be a, let's basically be a driver for any kind of inflammation, and wouldn't hurt to take some probiotics, although again, doing a more, taking a more thorough history, which I'm not going to quiz you about your bowel movements on the radio, but there are a lot of things as a functional medicine doctor that you ask, a lot of questions you ask that like, you kind of know what's going on, and sometimes you'll get the lab test to convince the patients because you're asking them to do stuff, and there's something so powerful about a piece of paper there and, you know, says, yeah, you've got this, as opposed to somebody else's say-so who's asking you to do something hard. So depending on the patient and how I feel they're responding, I may sometimes do testing, but we're not going to go there right now. I hope that this has been helpful for you.
I'm going to call you and set up an appointment with your functional assessment. Yeah, it has been helpful, and just very lastly, I'll let you go, but what is the dose of Boswellia? Do you take it in tincture?
About 500 milligrams three times a day is would be good. You can take a little less, maybe 300 three times a day, but it's it's best to keep to try to take it with food. So if you take it with your meals, and even though you collapse your meals, and you can take it on an empty stomach as well. So you take some at bedtime if you want. All right.
Okay.
You have a great day. Bye-bye. Thanks for the call.
Sure. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye. This from Sybil in Soquel. A product BioSil containing 100 milligrams of choline and 5 milligrams of silicon as choline-stabilized orthosilic acid, supposedly good for joints, bones, hair, skin, nails, promoting advanced collagen generator. It has been tested in double-blind placebo-controlled trials for both efficacy and safety. What's your opinion? Well, Sybil, I couldn't find those double-blind controlled trials, so I can't really speak to how good the research was. I did go to Google Scholar, and I think and I looked up silicone and arthritis and silicone treatment for arthritis, and essentially got no hits. I got a lot of hits, but none of them described silicone as a treatment for arthritis. So I think the silica may just be on along for the ride. And so I think the silica might just be along for the ride. And so what I'm looking for there is more data before I give you a comment on it. One thing I will say that kind of made me a little nervous about this is collagen generator. Ain't no such thing. That term does not exist. There is no collagen generator. So I don't know what they were talking about. I did find something interesting, though. I mean, I did go to the back pages of Google for you, dear. And this is from 1978. It's the British Medical Journal. It's a letter to the journal, Hard Water, Food Fiber, and Silicon. And basically, they report something called the Schwartz hypothesis, that if you have high levels of silicon in your water, that there seems to be a reverse relationship between atherosclerosis and arthritis. And then this author, who is named Bassler and writing from Inglewood, California, wrote in, our interest in the Schwartz hypothesis was stimulated by his analysis of hair samples from cardiac patients. We submitted samples from cardiac patients, marathon runners, and patients who were in exercise rehab program. Some cardiac patients were disabled by musculoskeletal injuries during training, and these had very low levels of hair silicon. Normal levels were found in champion marathon runners, and patients who were supplementing their diets with bran and alfalfa had higher levels. So they basically put their cardiac rehab patients on fiber with the idea that there's a lot of there's a lot of silicon and fiber, and maybe that will help them. Non-placebo controlled, interesting hypothesis, 1978, hasn't become a thing yet. So you can make of that what you want, but I'll, if you could find those articles and send me actual links to articles that open, I would be happy to review them and comment, because I get the silicon question quite a bit. But honestly, if it does help joints, it's probably helping them because of the other component. So let's go to Randy in Watsonville. Hello, Randy, and welcome to the program.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Glad to hear you on another channel.
Yeah, you found us.
Yes. So I'm 67, and my prostate is enlarged, nothing new for a guy. My PSA just went up a little bit. I think that's 6. I can't remember, but I did a K4 score, and I'm at 11. I just had an MRI, but I don't have the results. And I'm thinking about getting a Urolift. So
mm-hmm.
I'm questioning, what do you think about the K4 score test and the Urolift procedure?
Well, let me start with the second one first. And
I vary from peeing 4 times a night to none, and sometimes I really haven't feel that urgency to pee, and I hardly pee any.
Well, okay, so the prostate is an interesting organ, and it keeps growing throughout your life, and oddly enough, so does the lens of your eye. That's why we get cataracts. Gets crowded in there. A lot of people get an irritated urethra, and so some of the drugs, like Flomax and some of the other alpha-adrenergic blockers, can work for that urethral irritation. And if you're kind of going up and down, that sort of suggests that that may be a component for you. Have you tried the drugs?
No.
Okay. So I would say drugs before surgery every time, or even invasive procedures. Urolift has got a reasonable safety track record. I have been underwhelmed by results, but that may be because the patients that I have sent for it have had fairly advanced disease. And that's an idea. So let's talk about that 4K score. The trade name is Flomax, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the generic name for it. But Flomax is basically what we're talking about. And those drugs are, they're useful. And a lot of people get what they need from them. I also always try people on saw palmetto and nettle.
Okay.
And that's, that's also a really beneficial thing.
And is that drug for your urethra inflammation or irritation?
Actually, it's a vascular drug. It's very close relative to a blood pressure medication. And the blood pressure medication historically helped people's prostates, but we didn't want to lower the blood pressure, so someone kind of found a related molecule that wasn't a very good blood pressure medication. You know, they kind of go back to the shelves and they dust off something that didn't do well in clinical trials, but does it have the side effect of helping the prostate? And it's, so the generic name for just came to me is Tamulosin, Tamulosin.
Very good.
Okay, so basically getting to this 4K score, it's a predictor, and it's looking at something called prostate-specific kallikrein, and that's a protein, if you will, that's made in the prostate, and they have an algorithm. So they basically measure your prostate-specific kallikrein assay levels, and then they look at your age. They, basically, it's kind of like Nick the Greek handicapping you to get prostate cancer. So it's like, well, how many races has the horse won? How old is the guy? You know, what's the family history? Does he have risk factors, you know, like smoking, et cetera? Does he have, is he African-American because they have higher rates of prostate cancer? Things like that.
Yeah, my doctor said below 7 and below is in the safety zone, so I'm just a little bit above it at 11.
Mm-hmm. I don't actually have the scale memorized, but let's say that you're just above the safety zone. Your MRI looks good. What's your PSA? Do you know?
I think it was like 6.5.
Okay. So if you had the negative, if your MRI was not suspicious, it would, you could legitimately stall, you know, take some of these prostate agents that we're talking about, get your symptoms under control, and then see whether you get relief, because you're really asking two questions. And one of which is, what do I do with a gray zone risk for prostate cancer? And basically, you get an MRI, and then if that's not really looking good, you get biopsies.
Right.
And you could also just do watchful waiting. And if the score keeps getting worse, then it's like, okay, let's just get the biopsies. But the biopsies themselves don't necessarily, they obviously aren't biopsying every cell in your prostate. So if you have just a small focus, it's easy to miss it, particularly if it's on the edges. And so sometimes we just kind of have to wait for things to declare themselves. And this is the unfortunate state of affairs we're at with prostates. So let's separate symptom control from early detection of cancer, because they're really two different threads.
Oh, that's good to know.
Any follow-up questions?
No, that you answered a lot of questions and gave me a good insight, and I'll probably do the drugs and not do the UroLift, because we were going to be on my next visit in a couple of weeks is going to be like a consult to do that. He didn't even offer the drug thing, so I will mention that to him.
Yeah, you could probably get it from your primary care doctor as well. As far as the surgeons go, I've got, you know, surgeons get paid to operate.
Yeah, I'm seeing a urologist, and I don't know if he does. I guess he does.
They're the surgeons. Yeah, they're urologic surgeons. Okay. Well, anyway, I think the 4K score has a lot of potential, and it's got it doesn't have a long track record. Nothing can when it's new. And so as it generates more of a track record, I think it will start to be covered by insurance. Right now, it's generally something you have to pay for by yourself, I'm seeing here.
Oh, and my insurance paid for it.
Well, that's good to know. Okay.
Yeah. So, well, very good. So I'm glad I can move slowly on this and try some meds first. And you've answered a lot of questions, so thank you.
Very good. I'm glad I could help. Have a great day and keep listening.
All right. I'm a member of K-Squid.
All right. Go you. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Well, another story I had here in my pack. We're getting lots of pings and resonances, and I just love that. Pings and resonances. This is a study examines prostate cancer treatment decisions. So if you're out of the gray zone and walking down the path of prostate cancer, one of the things that you will be presented with is options for treatment. And this is a study recently published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It's a 5-year study, and it's lovely, helpful for people who are trying to make decisions, because it actually provides numbers and probabilities, let you know what your odds are. So they looked at, for over 5 years' time, 1,300 men who had favorable risk prostate cancer and another 619 with unfavorable. And that's the Gleason score. If it's above 7 or above, you're unfavorable. And I think if it's 4 or below, you're favorable. I'm not sure they use that in this study, but that's generally how we think about it. The favorable prognosis group had 4 choices. They could do active surveillance, which is an observational strategy in which you just watch the cancer and see if it gets worse. A procedure called nerve-sparing prostatectomy, which is surgical removal of the prostate, but you preserve the nerves that run next to the prostate. That reduces the chances of having an impact on erectile function, but it also leaves behind some prostate tissue, so you can't be sure you got all of the cancer. External beam radiation, EBRT, which is the kind of radiation that you hear about where beams are directed at the body, usually several crossing beams, so that where the beams cross, you have a higher dose of radiation, and that way the tissues on the way in and on the way out don't get such a big dose. And something called low-dose rate brachytherapy, where you implant radioactive seeds into the prostate itself. People in the unfavorable disease group were choosing either a full prostatectomy, forget about the nerve sparing, and the external beam radiation with a drug to stop hormone production of androgens is given, putting the man through a rather abrupt menopause, which is no fun. All of the men who underwent surgery had a sharp decline in erectile function compared to other groups. But if you wait, some of them goes get better over time. Most of those who did irradiation did not have a sudden decline in sexual functioning. They had a gradual decline. So when you get 5 years out, there really wasn't any difference between those two things. So sexual functioning, including just surveillance, these were all associated with significant declines because, hey, your sexual function declines as you age. And this was over 5 years in older men. So it doesn't really matter if you get surgery or radiation, but the people who get radiation decline more slowly. Only about half of the men who can have intercourse before treatment will still be able to have it after treatment, regardless of the type of treatment they have. So when you're thinking about, this is the decision my father made himself, which, while he has prostate cancer, killed him a decade later. He chose the EBRT and hormone deprivation therapy. And in his case, it was unsuccessful. In the long run, his residual cancer started to grow without testosterone being on board. And as I said, eventually killed him. The men who were undergoing radiation therapy had worse irritative and obstructive symptoms within the first 6 to 12 months. And that includes the brachytherapy group. However, they got better after about a year. Bowel function stayed the same at the five-year mark. And the EBRT group definitely did better than the brachytherapy group in terms of complications. Health benefits were considered equivalent. So now we've got a study. They've got some more funding. They're going to be following this out over time. But it does allow people to get a sense for what their risks are, and there's lots of numbers. Leakage in particular at 5 years, about 10 to 16% of men who had surgery had moderate or a big problem with leakage. Only 4 to 7% of men who took the other treatments did. So that'd be a point against surgery, and it'll be nice to see as we get more data exactly what that other data tells us. So time for a little good news, I think. I wanted to tell you about the latest work on reversing Duchenne muscular dystrophy with CRISPR, actual gene therapy. This type of muscular dystrophy is a fairly common hereditary disease, leaving most of the children who get it wheelchair-bound by the age of 12 and reducing their overall life expectancy due primarily to cardiovascular complications. People who have this disorder are missing a functional gene for a protein called dystrophin. And if they don't make this gene, their existing muscle cells, while they grow and form normally, deteriorate. They don't last. And so they're gradually replaced by connective and fatty tissue. Over the time, the muscle strength weakens, and the first symptoms usually occur around the age of 5. Generally, climbing stairs or getting up off the floor becomes difficult. And by the age of 12, they're no longer able to walk. Most people do not live past 40 because cardiac and respiratory failure kills them. It's the dystrophin gene is on the X chromosome. You need two bad copies. And of course, as we girls have two copies, so we have a much better chance. Males have only one copy of the X chromosome most of the time. And therefore, they are not able or more likely to suffer from the absence of this gene. Now, there is an animal model for this, and these are in pigs who've been, basically created to have muscular dystrophy. They used a special device called CRISPR-Cas9, and they were able to correct the dystrophin gene in these pigs, and they put a corrected copy directly into the DNA. just for a moment, that if you're not familiar with CRISPR, let me take a moment and tell you about this amazing bit of bacterial engineering that happened around 2013 at our own UC Berkeley. And what they have here is something that the bacteria uses as an immune system to chop up viruses, but you can repurpose it to chop up and replace. So essentially, this CRISPR-Cas9 is like giving a hound dog a handkerchief to sniff. It gets a 20 base pair sequence. 20 base pairs is pretty unique in the DNA, and it finds it. When it finds it, it makes a cut at the end of that recognition sequence, and it removes a gene. When it removes that gene, if you happen to be carrying along on the CRISPR molecule another copy, a good copy of the gene, and you just drop it right there, release it essentially, the gene repair mechanisms grab it and put it in there because it matches the opposite side. So you fix the DNA, and now you have a good copy. And when it replicates, you get more good copies. In the case of heart muscles, we're born with about half of the heart muscles we'll ever have. They're very long-lived cells. So the fact that this CRISPR can actually get in and fix the DNA means that it is a long-term fix. Now, the other thing that could be done, and I hope will not be done because I don't think it's ready for prime time yet, is if you had a person with a woman, let's say, who had or a father who had a known, I guess it would have to be the mother, who had a known dystrophin gene. Maybe her brother has muscular dystrophy. You could, in fact, check her DNA, fix the muscular dystrophy gene on her egg, and fix it if you were to get really fancy. You could fix all her eggs so that you could remove this gene from the family line forever. Now, you could also, of course, put new things in. And that's why germ cell transformation is the biggest biological no-no, because once you put it in the species, it's going to breed true. You want to be careful what you do there. Just for those who want to look it up, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, if you're Googling that, it's D-U-C-H-E-N-N-E. More good news? Possibly interesting stuff. Can lithium halt the progression of Alzheimer's disease? There's a controversy in scientific circles regarding the value of lithium therapy in treating Alzheimer's disease. There have been a number of studies, and they haven't all agreed, probably because they've used different approaches, conditions, formulations, timing, and doses of treatments, so you can't really compare them. But lithium at higher doses is a pretty toxic drug, so there hasn't been a lot of interest in this until recently. This team at McGill University has found that there's a special formulation of lithium that facilitates passage into the brain. You can use lithium at doses of 400 times less than what is currently given for people with mood disorders, which is doses of upwards of 100 to 200 milligrams. By the way, in my functional medicine practice, I will sometimes use an over-the-counter form of lithium called lithium orotate at 5 milligrams, in other words, 1/20th of the first lowest therapeutic dose, and therefore quite non-toxic. It can be remarkably good at calming and mood stabilization. I don't have a double-blind placebo-controlled study to cite. There's not that many of those when you're talking about something that's over-the-counter because how do you get the funding? But there is certainly, in my clinical experience and that of my functional medicine colleagues, a good reason to try this in people who are having problems with mood stability. When we talk about these carrier molecules, I want to relate it to a form of magnesium that I've recently been using also as a mood stabilizer. This form of magnesium is called magnesium threonate, T-H-R-E-O-N-A-T-E. And the magnesium threonate is magnesium, and a carrier molecule that's only there because people went looking for a molecule that would cross the blood-brain barrier and drag the magnesium along with it, because you can't get high enough levels of brain magnesium to get a good calming benefit in a lot of people. So this magnesium threonate was designed to deliver more magnesium. You'll see it commercially under the name Magtine. They did go ahead, having found this molecule, they did go ahead and patent it. And while I don't know the specific compound that they were using, given that magnesium and lithium are both ionic compounds, I suspect that it is the same or a similar compound, something with high avidity for the blood-brain barrier, so it can get across. So they used a transgenic mouse model of Alzheimer's. This is the mouse that gets lots of amyloid plaque, and they accumulate in the brain. It's an interesting question whether that's really a good model for Alzheimer's, because most of the drugs that have been aimed at it haven't really worked. But microdoses of lithium in early amyloid pathology stages seem to make a big difference, stimulating the removal of the amyloid, which is, of course, the holy grail here. The second study that I'm talking about tonight used later stage animals who were already showing signs of Alzheimer's disease, and they saw improved pathology, lower levels of plaque, but also improved cognition. And so that implies that this could be a really good, and I would add, inexpensive and readily produced therapy for people with Alzheimer's. So it hasn't been shown to be to work in humans with either early or late onset Alzheimer's. So don't go scarfing up the lithium just yet, folks. But I do think this is a promising bit of information that gives us a really excellent reason to hope for the future. Another bit of recent new science, also short because we're closing in on the top of the hour, is a nanoparticle just invented at Michigan State and Stanford University. This is called the Trojan Horse nanoparticle. It is a homing pigeon. They put it in the bloodstream and it homes in on the atherosclerotic plaque. It has a high selectivity for a particular type of immune cell called monocytes. It also gets into macrophages, and it delivers a drug that stimulates the cell to eat and engulf cellular debris. Basically, it removes the dead and diseased cells at the plaque core and reduces plaque size. And this is in an animal study, of course. We haven't seen this in humans. But the idea of effectively sicking the macrophages on the plaque is certainly encouraging. Now, it might backfire, and it could potentially cause more heart attacks in the short term, because that plaque that's being attacked might get a little bit unstable while the little Pac-Mans eat it up. Nevertheless, if it proves to be a beneficial item in rats, it can be studied in humans, and who knows, we may have our own little Pac-Man going in and cleaning out our coronaries, and wouldn't that be a wonderful thing? Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.